This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. The wife-killing banker. Why'd you do it?
I didn't, since you asked.
You're going to fit right in. Everybody in here is innocent. Didn't you know that?
It's true that we didn't really bond until I had you score that Michael Fassbender poster for me, Josh.
That was a bold move here at Shawshank, Adam.
Totally anachronistic, too, but somehow you pulled it off. This week, we head to The Clink, The Slammer, The Big House to name our top five movie prisoners. Plus, we'll discuss the acclaimed new UK prison drama Startup. That and more.
Get busy reviewing or get busy dying.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around the bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on.
This episode of Film Spotting is sponsored by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM.
We're also brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including new $10 a month subscriber Carmen from Parts Unknown, $5 a month subscriber Raymond from Rochester, New York, and Scott from Clarkston, Michigan, who says, keep up the forward inertia in your film watching and avoid the inertia that is marked by sluggishness and inactivity.
You got that straight, Adam?
Got that straight. Scott was the one who called me out for my use of the word inertia in an old Sin City review. We had some fun with that on a recent show. We thank Scott for his vocabulary and for his donation. And as always, thank everyone who helped support the show this past week. You're listening to Film Spotting, where Josh had the chance to do the voice of God there in the billboard and blew it.
I did.
You totally
blew it.
It
was really embarrassing.
This week's top five movie prisoners. Just before the show started, Josh gave me his number four pick in exchange for a pack of cigarettes.
They were e-cigs, actually. I do as Stephen Dorff does.
You do whatever you got to do in prison. Plus, Quentin Tarantino's new day job inspires this week's poll question. All that later in the show.
First, our review of a British prison drama with a breakout performance by a volatile young actor. No, Bronson and Tom Hardy aren't getting the sacred cow treatment. It's Jack O'Connell in Startup.
Eric Love, 19, is Startup on.
I'm going to tell you something, all right? This is no young offender's turnout.
You have to behave. Because I will kill you.
Kids causing issues. You know what's necessary.
In case you haven't fully appreciated, I am his father.
Except for that time you and I got a little crazy on the Ferris wheel outside WBEZ Studios here, Adam. Remember, we had to spend some time in the Navy Pier brig. Neither of us has had a lot of experience with correctional facilities. So I'm guessing you watched Startup similarly to the way I did, with a mixture of morbid curiosity and an unmanly level of fear.
Mm-hmm.
What would it be like to find yourself locked up in one of these places? Along those lines, Startup has a claustrophobic initiation scene. Eric Love, played by Jack O'Connell, is a youth offender in the British prison system who's been starred up, sent ahead of schedule to an adult facility. The movie opens by clinically capturing his admittance process. He's issued a series of rough commands. He's marched through an endless maze of gates and doors. Through it all, Eric maintains a veneer of tough guy composure and purposeful nonchalance. But I think we do catch a wince of vulnerability flicker across his face when he's ordered to squat as part of the contraband check. Eventually, he's ushered to his cell where the door is slammed shut. He drops his guard and lets free an expression of self-disgust, it seemed to me. Notice how quickly he glances past the mirror that's in the cell. Then he gets to the business of creating a shiv and hiding it in the ceiling. At this point, we're left alone with him, and I'm curious what you felt right there in Startup's opening scenes. Were you afraid for Eric or afraid of him? And did those feelings change by the film's end?
It is true that that opening initiation, as you put it, is pretty benign. When he comes in, there's a real procedural sense to it. He doesn't ever lose his cool or act threatening. The guards don't ever lose their cool or act threatening with him. But I was probably more afraid of him just based on having read the plot description in the video when I ordered it on demand. Couldn't really look away from it. And it says this: condemned to an adult prison, an explosively violent young man must fight for survival against criminal forces. Help comes from the unlikeliest source, his estranged father.
Played by Ben Mendelsohn.
Yeah, and Ben Mendelsohn, we'll get to that. I'm not sure that line is accurate, as plot descriptions sometimes aren't.
Probably not, yeah.
But that first line, just having that in my head, there's nothing really to base a perception of him on as he walks in. It's wordless for the first 10 or 15 minutes. It's just a lot of physical action. I think you put it well, purposeful, nonchalant. So it's hard to read. If I didn't know that line, explosively violent young man, I probably wouldn't really have had any sense of him whatsoever. We don't know at that point that he's been starred up or what that even means. We just know that he looks a little bit young and he is coming in to this new prison. But knowing that he's explosively violent, trusting that, I was waiting for him to explode. And it doesn't take too long for him to unleash a beating on someone. I think it's the first time we really see violence in the movie. It's the guy across the hall. And it's fitting, I think, that it's completely based on a misunderstanding. Not that the force he uses could be justified, but it's a legitimate reaction in the moment that he does regret when he learns what the true circumstances were. And I think that's how most of the violence in this place in life occurs, because of misunderstandings or confrontational moments that just push past the point of no return for these men. And I think there is a huge part of the suspense of this movie is knowing that violence can erupt at any moment just based on that slightest misunderstanding or just one word that someone takes the wrong way. By the end, I was definitely more afraid for him. And it's not just because of the danger lurking every day in that prison that we see, danger that will likely find you no matter how much you try to hide from it, but because I did certainly feel sympathy for him. There is a lot we learn that's been stacked against this kid from the start. And there is a certain sense of justice too, Josh, that accompanies most of his actions. You don't get the sense he takes particular pleasure in doling out these beatings. And we do learn that the crime he's actually in prison for fits this notion of justice. It's just the nature of the world he lives in, and he has to act accordingly. There's even kind of a Fight Club idea where the only way he seems to feel anything is to feel pain. And I think once you sort of tap into that, obviously he's not someone you would feel comfortable spending a lot of time with, but you do see that humanity in him. You see that he is the product of his environment. And because of that, definitely by the end of the film, I felt that empathy and that sympathy for him and wasn't fearful of him at all.
I'm glad you mentioned regret, because you're right. That's definitely something he expresses after that initial beating, and he finds out what he thought was going to take place didn't. It was sort of a defensive posture, a defensive action he takes to the extreme, because we learn that is maybe his nature. Maybe that's how he's had to survive. The fact that he expresses that regret, and even more than that, he tries to make amends for it in a completely naive way. He tries to convince the warden, or perhaps it's one of the head guards at that point, that it was a misunderstanding, and he thinks he can explain his way out of it. And that, to me, speaks to the fact that he is, to some degree, a kid.
Yeah.
Even though he's obviously experienced by making that shiv, it's an immediate reaction. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is what I've got to do. I'm here, get my defensive weapons that I can and prepare for what's coming. So you know he's an experienced kid, but yet there's somewhere in there that naivete of this can be made right, perhaps, in some way.
He at least tries.
He tries, and there's something so tragic about that. So my answer to the question about if I feared for him or was afraid of him is, from that very beginning, both. And I think this is a real mark of this film, that they're able to pull this off. The writer is Jonathan Asser, and it's directed by David McKenzie. They're able to realize that this kid is, to some degree, a menace, a menace to society, for sure. He has that capability. But they never lose sight of his humanity. And it's not even something that I, at least, came to realize towards the end. Some films will do that. Well, finally, they'll get you to see the other side of person. It's something that's held in its hands both sides at once throughout the film,
yeah,
which I think is a pretty impressive achievement.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I also want to credit the director, McKenzie, and the DP, Michael McDonough, who also shot Winter's Bone.
Right.
And I think they really effectively draw out, use the word claustrophobic, I think. There is a sense of claustrophobia that you would expect in a prison, but it's heightened here without them really having to dig into any sort of bag of tricks to give you that sense. There's not any real playing with the depth of field where it's really shallow and you only see the characters right in front of you, or only relying on really close, tight shots. We do follow these characters in this space, but the space is just so cramped. It's so linear, and it's always shooting these vertical rooms, the cells, or these vertical hallways. And so there really is this sense of these characters just stuck and, again, trying to explode, because what else can they do but try to burst out of these walls? And they also don't go for what you might expect. And we've seen in other prison dramas where you can go that harsh antiseptic look where it's all kind of white or it's all shades of gray. There's color here, but it's all mostly a brownish yellow.
It's monotonous.
That isn't in any way happy or inviting.
No, no. I'm glad you mentioned the cinematography, because I think it is a hallmark of the film. Overall, the production is very minimalist. There's not a lot of dialogue. Not much of it can you understand if you're not familiar with the dialect being used in the film. So it's very much a movie of gestures, physical action, confined spaces, minimalist sound design. And yet, despite that, that makes it sound like, and it did remind me at many points of a Dardenne Brothers film. They often will shoot from behind one of the characters as they're walking.
They follow this guy.
Following
I thought
someone.
Of it as well. You're right.
So I think that is a trait. But then there are these little breakaways where the cinematography doesn't get show-offy, but it allows something else to enter the picture. And they set this up in that almost every scene of a claustrophobic room also somewhere has a window in it, in this facility, and there's light coming through the window, and that comes into play later on. There's a payoff in a couple of moments where Eric is alone in his cell. And the first one I think of is, I believe he's smoking and he's blowing rings into the sunshine that's coming through that window. And it's a reverie moment. It's a quiet moment of respite that's a break from everything else. There's another one where he's leaping. I forget if he's jumping rope or he's leaping into the air and he blocks the sunlight. We see his silhouette. And these are almost something like from a Malick film all of a sudden. And I just liked that contrast where it is predominantly minimalist and oppressive and claustrophobic, but we do get these little breathing spaces that speak to another side of Eric, his character, I think, and speak to another side of the world, the possibility of another world, at least.
If you comply with the regime, I'm prepared to offer you a place back on the wing. And a special kind of therapy with Mr. Baumer, with whom you cooperated upstairs. But one more incident of any kind that comes to my attention, you'll be straight back down here.
Just one problem.
You're going to tell me what that is.
I'm just saying. Say this therapy goes well, and it changes my life, and I rehabilitate. And then you lay it on for the next geezer, and it works for him, and the next. And everything's sweet, yeah? Crime rates start to come down, police got less people to nick, court's got less people to convict. Pretty soon, you're out of a job.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new UK prison drama Startup. I didn't think about Malik in any of those shots, but it's funny you bring him up because the same thing he's seeking, I think, with a lot of his visuals is the same thing we get here, not just maybe a sense of respite, but this idea of transcendence, mm-hmm. that there is something outside these walls. There is something outside the confines of these characters' heads, even, that they can aspire to. And it could have just been this gritty, bleak, hard, violent drama. And it's all of those things.
I think it predominantly is
just that.
Right.
And you're right. It finds ways to transcend that and give us this concept of transcendence. The language is something to talk about as well. And maybe for people who are listening and thinking of seeking this movie out, they can take a cue from us one way or another here, because this is the first time I've ever paid twice to watch a movie once.
So that you could watch it with subtitles?
I started watching it on demand. It was available via cable on demand. So, of course, I'm going to choose my TV versus my laptop or plugging my laptop into the TV.
Right.
Why don't I just go ahead and watch it on that TV? So that's what I did. And I got about 20 minutes into it. And I was having such a hard time making out what they were saying,
mm-hmm.
just because of the nature of the language, the way they speak, but also because they're often using slang. The title is a slang term, Startup. That gives you a cue that the film is filled with this type of language. And I really found myself so lost. Now, of course, this movie is one where a lot of it is so physical. And as you said, there's a lot of silence to it as well. So it's not as if you can't get a sense of what's going on from the characters' faces and their actions. You can. But I also think the words are so important, because as we see throughout the film, it is those certain words that can start this explosion of violence. So I wanted to know what these characters were saying and really what they meant when they were saying things to each other. And I did get to about the 25-minute mark, and I said, I wonder if I buy this on iTunes, if I can turn on the subtitles. And sure enough,
okay.
I could. And I watched the rest of the film with the subtitles on. And not only that, with my laptop next to me so that I could pause the movie and go to Urban Dictionary. I did, and look up some of the terms, some of the words that they use, because otherwise I really do feel like I would have had a lesser experience. Not that I would have been lost necessarily, but somehow my experience would have been diminished. And I actually did read somewhere today a little snippet that apparently, not surprisingly, this has been brought up to the filmmakers. Obviously, they thought about the fact that a lot of us Americans would probably lose some of this stuff in translation, and they made the decision to not do any subtitles, not even in those moments where it's the toughest to understand them, which you'll see movies do sometimes.
Right.
They won't use them throughout the film, but in certain moments they will. They made an aesthetic choice. They thought that would somehow ruin the experience. And I get that and I respect that, but I also don't feel bad for a second about watching it with subtitles on.
I probably would have selected that as an option right away if I had had it. So I agree you might want to go that way. Yet I'll also go back to the degree of austerity to this film, mm-hmm. and the way dialogue works. I was pretty lost those first 20 minutes as well, but you get your bearings, and in a way, it's not so much the words that are spoken, but how they're spoken,
right.
or who's speaking them to who. And in a sense, that is something you detect more if you're not worrying about the actual meanings of the words themselves. So I did feel like I got my bearing enough eventually that I could follow that. And mm-hmm. I also think here's maybe where we can get into O'Connell's really impressive performance, because it is so physical. We talked about how he communicates a number of things in that opening scene. And really, it's a performance to me that was built on a series of tells, you could almost think of them as, because he's always putting on one, maybe two fronts, and then there's what he's thinking underneath. Mm-hmm. And it's just really impressive that an actor of his age is able to pull all of that off. We know that He has this bravado. We know that he has this rage. We've seen it erupt, and we know it can come out at any moment. But then there's the kid underneath, the one he's desperately trying to hide. And it's fascinating to watch him play all those levels at once, which I think he does in just about every scene. There's even a confession scene of a sort where he talks about how he ended up here or what his life was like before. And I'm not even sure I bought everything he was selling in that scene, even though it's supposed to be him burying his soul as much as he can. I partly wondered, is he playing another card here? And I think that's because his performance is so good.
Yeah, I'm with you completely on the performance by Jack O'Connell. And if you haven't seen the movie and maybe trying to visualize him in your head, I've got it perfectly for you. He's the love child of Channing Tatum and Anton Yelchin.
Yes, Anton Yelchin, exactly. There are photos of him where he's closely shaven his hair in this movie,
right,
but there's photos of him, press photos, with a lot more hair. Exactly.
Yeah,
that.
He's got that kind of kid-like face to him the way Yelchin does, but at the same time, he's bigger and a little more beefy. I know you don't like your men beefy. Or is that me that doesn't like my men beefy?
I forget.
I'm trying to remember that conversation we had several shows ago. It was me who doesn't like him beefy.
You don't
like
him beefy. Yeah,
he's not
I don't
quite,
think I'm big on the beefy either.
He's not quite Tatum-esque, but he is a character. You're right. This dance he has to do where he's someone who doesn't belong on the outside. You get the sense watching him that he is a menace in some ways, or we aren't probably safer with him walking around our streets, but he certainly doesn't deserve to be in this hellhole either. And I think that that comes through in the performance, where there's a completely unforced charm about him. He's never too naive and innocent, too childish, but he's never so hardened that that human side doesn't come through. I suppose you would call that a vulnerability, but sometimes when I think of vulnerability, we actually talked about this a little bit last week with our fall preview and James Gandolfini and Tom Hardy.
Right.
These are guys who are big, beefy men, and they can be really masculine and hard, but they're not afraid to completely break down or really show you a certain fragility. I don't know that you ever get a sense of fragility to Jack O'Connell, but just enough vulnerability peeking through to make him, as we've used this word now so many times, to make him human. And I think that there is, with all that said, as good as the performance is and the tells, I think there's so much subtlety to that. You're right, Josh. There is nevertheless a certain thrill I think you have to cop to in just watching him physically be this caged animal. When he's in that cell and he knows that they're coming in after him, there's no talking his way out of it. And at this point, he doesn't even really probably want to talk his way out of it.
No, this is the scene where he's oiling himself up,
yeah,
right?
He's
getting ready for the guards.
He's getting himself ready, and he knows, as he calls them, the goons are going to attack. So you know what? He's going to embrace the attack, and he's at least going to go down swinging. And as I said, maybe it's the only way he's going to feel anything anyway. This is all he really knows, and that all comes through in his performance.
And speaking of Hardy, that's the Bronson aesthetic, right?
Right.
A film I like very much.
I do too.
But that almost gives you that side of a character, full force, full bore. That's pretty much all you get. Again, I like the film quite a bit, but only because it zeroes in on this madness in its entirety and embraces it.
Mm-hmm.
And Hardy gives a performance, a shocking, really terrifying performance.
He does.
I don't know that that's a guy that you ever feel like maybe there's some other something there.
No.
It's been a while since I've seen the film, and maybe I'm not giving it enough credit on that score. But the distinction between the two pictures, because I think there will be a lot of comparisons, not only in the films, but in the performances, is that this movie does offer you that other little glimmer, which I really appreciated.
I do too. And I think maybe more similar to the Bronson character is the actor playing his father, playing Jack O'Connell's father, that is Ben Mendelsohn here. And he certainly doesn't have the stature. He's not physically imposing the way that Tom Hardy is or even Jack O'Connell is. But that's kind
the
of the
of
brilliance.
It.
That's the brilliance,
yeah,
of Ben Mendelsohn as an actor. And I've certainly been a fan of his since seeing him first in Animal Kingdom, where he's subtle there, but he's a complete psycho. He is evil.
He's probably the smallest guy of all those thugs, but the scariest, right?
Yeah, he absolutely is. And he isn't that evil here, but he is often as scary. And I just love the way Mendelsohn is able to be intimidating. It's through, first, just these dead eyes. You know, there's always this notion that he's looking right through you. He's either unable or unwilling to empathize with anyone that he's speaking to, or he's somehow peering into your soul. He knows a lot more about you than you're willing to let on. It's also, though, the way he moves his whole body. There's a kind of rigidity to it, but he swings his arms out to the side as he walks a little bit, as if he's almost a machine. He doesn't really care who is in his way. He owns that hallway. He owns this room. He owns that field. There will, at any moment, he is in complete control. And that is scary. And that does allow him to be physically imposing to people who are actually much bigger than him. It takes me back to our show last week as well, where I spoke with Dan Schechter, the writer-director of the Elmore Leonard adaptation Life of Crime. We brought up John Hawks in that movie. John Hawks is a guy in a movie like Winter's Bone that can be the smallest guy on screen, but be the scariest person you've ever seen in a movie. And then he can shift to a movie like Life of Crime or the movie he made with Helen Hunt. I'm blanking on the title of that film, where he can be the sweetest, most harmless man in the world. You kind of get that with Mendelsohn a little bit as well. Look at something like The Place Beyond the Pines with Ryan Gosling, where Mendelsohn is a criminal, but just in certain subtle physical shifts and mannerisms, he is a completely different person on screen and can be the complete opposite of a really scary figure like Neville, the dad, here in this movie.
What? What's going on? I'm sorry. You have to help him, you know. You have to teach him the answers, the things that he's supposed to say, you know, like the Think Right program. You know, help him get out. You know, like the what would you do if you're in a bar and a fella comes up, starts talking to your bird, what are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to tell him politely that I'm with her, you know, rather than a glass of cunt. You know what I mean? Exactly. At bollocks.
Okay. That's not what my group is about. Your son and I are on a journey together, and we will...
No, he needs to behave.
Okay, he's suffered enormous emotional trauma and abuse.
Oh, I never touched him.
You weren't there.
I didn't. Okay, that's enough. All right.
When Mendelsohn is looking at somebody, they're not human. To him, they're an obstacle or they're a tool. And what's interesting about the way Startup uses that quality is when you bring his son into the mix, that throws off those calibrations a little bit, because now here is someone clearly an estranged son, but still his son. And you're not quite sure if the affection that he shows or the discipline, he really shows more discipline than anything that he shows, is out of a fatherly instinct or is it out of a mercenary instinct? Mm-hmm. Is his son just another tool for playing the power games that go on in this hall? So that dynamic really adds a lot to the film. I'm curious what you make of another dynamic. A whole aspect of this picture is the class. Well, they don't like to call it a class.
But it's therapy.
They call it a meeting.
Yeah,
it's
I'm really glad therapy. You went here because we have to talk about it.
And initially it starts because Eric, during one of his outbursts, gets a guard, let's just say pinned, in a difficult situation.
Yeah.
And this happens in the midst of one of these therapy classes. Eric isn't a member of the class yet. The action kind of spills into one. And the counselor, who's played by Rupert Friend, his name is Oliver, the character's name, stands up and he's able to somehow diffuse it simply by using a different tone towards Eric. And after that, Eric ends up joining this class a little bit reluctantly. There's some more manipulations that go on behind the scenes to get him there. And that becomes a central point of the movie. How did that work for you?
That scene or that
overall
thread
that
throughout?
Thread?
No, it really worked for me because it never devolves into what you sort of fear it might devolve into, which is, as much as I like these films, I did sort of cynically keep waiting for it to become Ordinary People or Goodwill Hunting, where the therapist is going to get the character to break down and have a breakthrough and he's going to forgive himself and it's just going to be this
the
wonderful,
inspirational teacher cliche.
Yeah, shiny happy moment where exactly right, like we've seen in so many movies. And this movie is smart enough to know that some of these wounds just probably aren't ever going to be healed. And these characters aren't going to be changed forever. And these problems all aren't going to be solved. Even if he makes progress, which I do think we see him make, there's a sense of hope to that, but never this idea, I think, maybe to me anyway, I think it's one of the questions you can ask about this film when it's over is, do you think Eric is ever maybe going to be a productive member of society? Can those wounds be not healed, but can they be salved enough that he might end up getting out of here and doing something with his life? And that makes me think of characters that I mentioned, like Conrad in Ordinary People and Will in Goodwill Hunting. Even a character like Will coming from a similar background and having some of the same problems growing up. those characters both have a lot more options in life than someone like Eric does. So even if he gets out of here, whether it's him staying in prison for however many more years or him getting out of here, there are always going to be people trying to provoke him. And is he ever really going to be able to live in that world and not respond to that provocation? I don't know, but it's still very intriguing to watch him make some progress.
I think it does flirt a little with some of those cliches
in
certain scenes, but it backs off just in time and just at the right time. And usually, interestingly, it explodes them in the middle of one of the therapy sessions because they do make incremental progress. And just before you think these guys are going to go into a group hug, going back to the language, something will be said as an aside and the whole room just erupts.
Mm-hmm.
And those scenes are so well handled and choreographed because the counselor, Oliver, he is outmatched here. I mean, just about everybody in the room is bigger than him and certainly more violent than him. And all he does is stand up along with everyone else. And at least in the scene I'm thinking of, he looks down.
Yeah.
And he's just, but what he is he's there.
He is there.
He's not.
Often between them.
Often between them, but not in an aggressive referee way.
No.
He hasn't abandoned them and left the room. He's not disciplining them, but he's there waiting for that little glimmer of their better selves that he's been helping them to find to show up, hoping for his very life that they show up, really, because the situation is so dangerous. And I think that speaks to the larger question that the movie is interested in. Some people might think, and if you lock onto the group therapy narrative, that the most important question is, can this kid become a more productive member of society? And I think the movie is actually interested in something deeper that doesn't matter where he ends up in 10 years, whether it's inside or out.
Yeah.
It's asking the question, does this kid matter?
Right.
Does any of these people in here matter, or should they just be left to their own base impulses and tear each other apart? And so that's why I think Startup is really after a lot bigger things than just your average prison drama.
I agree. And I think you're dead on in the way you describe what you like about those scenes with Oliver, because you almost can't imagine him standing there any longer, but he never does get aggressive. And it's because I think he recognizes that he has to let them come to these conclusions on their own. If he's just another authority figure saying, stop doing this, don't you see this, you can be better than this, it's not going to be effective. They have to realize it on their own. And so he does kind of stay out of that. Now, if I'm being really, really picky, Josh, with this notion of sentimentality and how the movie comes right up against it but doesn't really go past it, there is a moment at the end of the film, not spoiling anything, but I love it. I love everything emotionally, psychologically,
between
the moment
father
suggests.
And son?
There
Can
is
I
a father
that?
And son,
That's
yes.
What you're talking
there is
about.
A father and son moment.
Beautifully handled.
That is beautiful, but there is a line of dialogue I don't think we needed. I don't think we needed that line of dialogue to
between
punctuate
them?
It. Yeah, between them. Yeah.
Did the subtitles give you that?
I don't think so, because it's pretty blatant.
My memory is that we don't hear or understand what they're saying, which is exactly what I liked about it.
No, we'll have to discuss it off air, maybe. But I really thought it was clear he wasn't very mumbly with the way he expressed that at all.
I read it as a lost in translation moment. I did. Maybe I was completely
He's not whispering it,
not
though, in that
attention.
Moment or anything.
Okay. Now I want to revisit that.
Well, Startup is out now in limited release, including playing here in Chicago. It is also available via on demand and for rental through iTunes. You can buy it twice, like I did, if you so choose. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Up next, Quentin Tarantino and Martin Scorsese face off in the film spotting poll, although it's not their filmmaking abilities we'll be considering. Then Adam and I will dig a tunnel into the studio next door to share our top five movie prisoners. Stay with us.
Peoria Jazz! Go Dudlow Joe! I can break out of any old chair you know. The bars are iron, the walls are stone. All I need, man, is a whole fishbone. Some fish in the jailhouse tonight. Some fish in the jailhouse tonight. Some fish in the jailhouse tonight. All right. Oh yeah. There's some fish in the jailhouse tonight. Oh boy. There's some fish in the jailhouse. Fish in the jailhouse tonight.
Quick interruption here to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and for 10% off, go to squarespace.com. Use the offer code FILM.
A testimonial comes to us this week from a listener named Sachin Darwadkar. He says, I've been listening to Film Spotting since 2011, the same year I made my first short film. Listening to you guys every week has since become a fixture in the crazy life of a young filmmaker. I'm a sophomore studying film at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts, and I recently launched a portfolio site for my work that runs on Squarespace. Thought I'd pass on the link for you guys to maybe share in your segment during the podcast. We are doing that indeed. That is SachinFilms.com, though Sachin is SachinFilms.com. Very happy to share that link with everyone. Thank you for the kind words there and the testimonial, Sachin. And if you have a Squarespace-built website you want us to feature on an upcoming show, just email us feedback@filmspotting.net. We've been talking about Squarespace for a few years here on the show, Josh, and we always highlight how they're improving their platform with new features and new designs, and how when you build a site, it's got a mobile experience tied into it, so it will always look the same on any device. Of course, the metric app that allows you to check site stats and page views. But we don't often talk about things like the 24/7 support, how everything is drag and drop, how you can easily connect Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Instagram, Google, and other web and social services. And I know our listeners like Sachin, who are filmmakers out there, you can easily embed videos and trailers via their YouTube and Vimeo integration.
You can also start a Squarespace trial without even having to use a credit card. Just start building your website. And then when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, do make sure to use the offer code FILM. That way you'll get 10% off, and you'll also show your support for Film Spotting. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Some fish in the jailhouse tonight.
Eyes cut by the bullets that killed him. From the great beyond, he will protect you. And the ones you love.
You want me to wear a mask?
The men you seek think you are dead, Kimosabe. Better to stay that way.
This is Film Spotting, and Josh, our listeners may be wondering, you, in fact, may be wondering why we just played a clip from 2013's The Lone Ranger.
We better have a good reason, since it was one of 2013's worst films.
It may take me a little bit of a roundabout way to get there, but I think there will be a payoff. In L.A., the New Beverly Cinema is famous, though on all my visits to L.A., I've never actually had a chance to see a movie there. It's a well-loved repertory movie house, very eclectic programming schedule. If you look at its upcoming calendar, they've got evenings devoted to Cassavetes, Tarkovsky, the late Eli Wallach. There's a 10th anniversary screening of Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle even. Another really cool thing about Beverly is that every ticket is for a double feature. A couple years ago, Quentin Tarantino buys the New Beverly, though he didn't, it seems, really have much of a direct role in the day-to-day operations of the place. But it was just revealed last week. Tarantino comes out and says he's going to take over. He's going to become not only the owner, but be the programmer for the New Beverly. And it's going to reopen in October. Our buddy Matt Singer over at The Dissolve recently wrote a nice piece about it. If you want to get the lowdown, if you missed this news about Tarantino and the New Beverly, we'll link to that in the show notes if you want to check it out.
All right. You still haven't explained, though, about The Lone Ranger.
Right. Back in October, Tarantino was asked to name his top 10 films of 2013 so far. Gore Verbinski's The Lone Ranger made the list, Josh.
Of course it did.
So apparently he disagrees with you about the quality of The Lone Ranger. Maybe we'll see Johnny Depp's Tonto at the New Beverly sooner than later. But with Tarantino taking on this programmer role at the New Beverly, it gave us the fodder for our latest poll question. We'll get to that in just a bit. We did want to share a quick note about our bonus content. If you haven't been partaking in it, I don't know, Josh, if our top five pre-CGI scenes feedback is going to match some of the stuff we've been diving into lately. Going back three shows, we got into some spoiler stuff with Boyhood. Two shows ago, it was our advice to aspiring critics. And
right,
we did that really casually completely at the last minute, didn't put a whole lot of thought into it, but have gotten a lot of really positive comments from people on Twitter, which is nice to see. And then last week we did have our The One I Love spoiler deathmatch.
Yes, that which we spent the majority of trying to figure out what had happened in the movie.
Yes.
I was listening to that again.
That's part of the fun.
And it's like, no, wait, that's not what happened. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Then once we had our bearings,
yeah,
we continued arguing about the movie.
That's exactly right. So this week, we're going to share some of that CGI scenes feedback, but we are also, Josh, going to get into some of the feedback we got on our Sacred Cow review of Dead Poets Society as part of our Robin Williams tribute. Specifically, we're going to discuss a topic you brought up in that review, which is homosexuality and how it is depicted or not depicted.
Oh, good. We got feedback on that. Excellent.
We did. We got some good stuff. So if you aren't regularly checking out our bonus content, you can get it if you have our app for Android, Windows 8 phone, or, of course, iOS. And all the information you need is at filmspotting.net. Just click on apps.
If you were locked in a room for the rest of your life, who would be in there with you?
Doris.
Who's Doris?
Best girl I met girl I'm going to marry one day.
Is she in Lynn?
Yes.
Lynn, Massachusetts?
Yes, sir.
And why aren't you with her?
I'm an idiot.
Why aren't you with that lovely girl?
I got no reason. I'm a fool.
Do you love Doris?
Yes.
Is she the love of your life?
Yes, sir.
Why aren't you with her?
I don't know.
Yes, you do. Tell me why you're not with her if you love her so much.
I told her I'd come back and I never went back and now I gotta get back to her.
Why don't you go back?
I don't know.
Why don't you go
back? I don't know!
Close your eyes.
Josh, if you were locked in a room for the rest of your life, who would be in there with you? Interstellar or Inherent Vice? Don't blink. From now on, I think it's a great idea for us to do these deathmatch pulls the master style.
I'm pretty good at staring contests. So
are you?
You could be in trouble.
We haven't had that yet here on the show. Joaquin Phoenix and the late Philip Seymour Hoffman, of course, there in that scene from Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master. In anticipation of our fall movie preview, which we shared with you last week, we posed the death match I just posed to Josh. The latest from Paul Thomas Anderson, an adaptation of Thomas Pynchon's Inherent Vice or Christopher Nolan's Interstellar. You can only see one of these fall movies. You'll never see the other one. Which one do you choose? Josh, how did it come out?
Nolan's Interstellar, 44% of the vote. So Inherent Vice wins, 56%. Not shocking.
Not shocking to you?
No.
Not shocking that PTA won or that Interstellar got as many votes as it did? Because I'm
I was glad to see it was a little closer than what I would have predicted, but I figured it would come out this way for sure.
James writes, if you look at it in terms of what have you done for me lately, one made a masterpiece and the other made an overlong, narratively incoherent mess, PTA all the way. Now, James isn't clear there. Which recent Nolan film is he calling the overlong, narratively incoherent mess?
I'm assuming...
Inception?
No, I'm assuming Dark Knight Rises? Rises, yeah. That's what would be,
yeah,
my guess.
Okay, I guess there are...
People were pretty so-so on that.
Yeah, there are some haters who think the narrative is a mess there. So I guess that's where James is going. We also heard from Zachary, who agrees on PTA.
PTA all the way. The simple fact is that Anderson's worst film, Hard Eight, is still better than Nolan's best film, The Dark Knight.
Ooh, that's a bold statement.
The only thing
it.
That will even motivate me to see Interstellar is the cast, particularly Jessica Chastain, who is easily one of my favorite actresses working today. I love those redheads, man.
That was your McConaughey?
Sure.
Close enough. You know what? If I was ranking, and I'm not saying this just to be incendiary, because it's probably not that incendiary, but if I was ranking films, every film I'd ever seen, Hard Eight's going ahead of The Dark Knight for me.
Is it going ahead of Inception? Is it going ahead of...
Yeah, probably.
Because your favorite Nolan film is The Dark Knight.
No, I don't think it probably is.
Okay.
But
Hard Eight is
saying,
that good.
I like Hard Eight enough that I do like it probably better than just about every
all
other
right,
Christopher
you and
Nolan
James,
film.
Fine.
Jeff says, sorry, but this isn't even a choice for me. Inherent Vice all the way. And I'm legit surprised the results are as close as they are. I don't want to live in a world where people are more excited about new Christopher Nolan than new P.T. Anderson.
Wow,
I'm with you,
now
Jeff.
We're just getting intolerant.
Yeah, I love it.
Brad says, I love PTA. That being said, oh, thank you, Brad. Interstellar is my choice. It will be this generation's 2001. Those are high hopes.
Yeah, I think talk about just being crazy.
I'm going to start backing off all of that as we get closer and closer
you
to
need
Interstellar.
To. I mean, I understand the comparison and that he may be going down that route. I think I even invoked it as well, but man, suggesting that it might actually be a film we equate with 2001 in terms of overall quality.
But does it speak a little bit to how Nolan is regarded by people, even those who may not appreciate him as much as PTA? I mean, it's not every time a filmmaker makes a space movie, people don't say, oh, it could be his 2001. It's only filmmakers that we do really respect, that we even jump to that sort of conclusion.
Isaac Ruiz says, I love PTA and my head says Inherent Vice will end up being a better film, but my heart completely votes for Interstellar. Everything from the cast to the ambiguous trailer has my anticipations rising through the roof. Knowing how epic and thrilling every Nolan film has been for me, it makes me head over heels excited for this film. Sorry, PTA, but I gotta pick Nolan on this one. So there you go. Pretty evenly split, and actually the votes, 56 to 44, maybe more evenly split than I anticipated. We do appreciate everyone who went to filmspotting.net and participated in that poll. We hope you'll do the same with this week's poll question. Again, going back to Quentin Tarantino and his plan to become the full-time programmer at the Repertory Los Angeles Movie Theater, the New Beverly, our poll question is going to pit Tarantino against maybe the only other living filmmaker as well qualified for such a job. And that's got to be Martin Scorsese. They're not only great filmmakers, two of the best we've got, I would argue, but also famous lovers of film and filmmakers who champion the obscure and the underseen. And if you look at their individual pantheons, their great films, Josh, they are very different. And I think to help set up this poll question, which we're going to ask you simply, which of these two famously movie-obsessed directors would you choose to program your local movie house? That's it, Tarantino or Scorsese. Looking at the films they list as their top 10 of all time is probably instructive. It will probably help you answer it.
It's very instructive. it essentially proves my instinct right.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and take Scorsese?
All right, his films are 2001, 8.5, Ashes and Diamonds, Polish film from 1958, Citizen Kane, The Leopard, Paisan,
Rossellini,
The Red Shoes, favorite here on the show, The River, that would be Renoir's, Salvatore Giuliano from Francesco Rossi, The Searchers, Ugetsu, that's a Mizoguchi, and Vertigo.
So some Hitchcock there, not surprising. You've got some Italian heavy hitters there on Scorsese's list. And here's Tarantino's, Apocalypse Now, The Bad News Bears, Carrie, Dazed and Confused, The Great Escape, His Girl Friday, Jaws, Pretty Maids All in a Row, Rolling Thunder, Sorcerer, Taxi Driver, and finally, A Little Leone, The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly.
And in a few years, after its reputation,
The Lone Ranger.
Proven The Lone Ranger. I mean, come on.
So where are you going?
Come on. I understand. There's contrarian, and then there's just having such an individual streak of taste, which I completely trust that these are the films he would pick. But is that what you want programmed in a theater that you're going to be going to regularly? I mean, you don't need a Repertory Theater to be showing The Bad News Bears.
You don't?
Which one is he talking about anyway?
The original.
Okay.
The original. It's the only one that matters.
Does it really matter?
Yeah, it does, because it's actually pretty good. And the other ones weren't.
But is this why we have Repertory Theaters? I mean, at some point, you have to take the concept seriously.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, obviously, apples and oranges here. This is his top 10 all-time favorite films, not the films he's going to program at the New Beverly. But it does probably give you some idea.
If he's true to his sensibility, he should.
He should. And I was so very clearly going with Scorsese here. Like, there was no way I wasn't choosing Scorsese. And when you look at 2001, 8.5, Kane, The Searchers, Vertigo, The Red Shoes, and then a few films I haven't seen. I have seen Paisan, others there that I do need to catch up with. It's hard for me to completely weigh Scorsese's against Tarantino's when I haven't seen, I think, four of those movies. I do love a lot of those Tarantino choices, though. Apocalypse Now,
there's a lot of good films on that list.
Jaws, Taxi Driver, The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly.
It's not a trash list.
No.
It's not a trash list. But when you look at the variety of films, the variety of regions of the world that is covered by Scorsese's, I would just and I'm thinking about this, you know, in reality, in real terms, I would be much more excited to see a schedule coming out a month ahead that Scorsese had programmed, because I would have no idea what would be on it. Now, you might say that for Tarantino.
I think you can.
But I think you'd have a pretty good idea what kind of films would predominantly be on it, if that makes any sense.
Okay. I don't know. This was much harder than I anticipated.
No,
it really was. Like, this was a slam dunk Scorsese for me, and now it's not anymore. It's just not. So we're going to see what our listeners think, Josh. You can vote now at filmspotting.net.
Anything else bothering you boys?
Yeah, just one little thing. How come you were so sure Manfredi and Johnson wouldn't get out of the forest?
I wasn't so sure. I just liked the odds. What's that crack supposed to mean?
They're lying dead out there in the mud, and I'm trying to find out how come.
I'll tell you how come. Because you, our security officer, said it'd be safe, and you, the barracks chief, gave him the green light. That's how come. What are you guys trying to prove, anyway? Cutting trap doors, digging...
Listen, Seth!
You listen to me! What do you think the chances are of getting out of here? And let's say you make it to Switzerland. Let's say to the States. So what? They ship you out the Pacific, slap you in another plane, you get shot down again, only this time you wind up in a Japanese prison camp. That is, if you're lucky. Well, I'm no escape artist. Cigar, Cookie. You can be the heroes. The guys with fruit salad on your chest. Me, I'm staying put. And I'm going to make myself as comfortable as I can. And if it takes a little trading with the enemy to get me some food or a better mattress, that's okay by Sefton.
If it's okay by Sefton, Josh, it's certainly okay with me. William Holden there as Sefton in Stalag 17, the Billy Wilder film. And that brings us into our top five this week, inspired by our review of the new film Startup. We are going to share our top five, not prison movies, but movie prisoners. We're picking the characters here, focusing on them more than the movies themselves. And I'm cheating a little bit because I had to get Stalag 17 in here somewhere. I'm actually calling it my Sefton Stalag 17 memorial list.
So it can be your top six list.
It can be my top six, okay. Is essentially what I'm saying. But it also, as we get through my picks, you'll see that it does kind of offer a nice umbrella for all of my choices. Okay. I think it does.
I love
make
it when your
sense.
Lists come with diagrams.
Yes. We're going to play Pictionary later as well. Some films that did get excluded otherwise because they're in the Pantheon. A little gem called Cool Hand Luke, Paul Newman. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, no R.P. McMurphy. Out of Sight, can't put Jack Foley or Glenn on this list. And yes, Midnight Run is in the film spotting Pantheon.
Pick.
So we're not going with Charles Grodin as the Duke in Martin Brest's classic Midnight Run. Those four films, ineligible.
Apparently, we hold very close to our hearts movies about prisoners.
Apparently,
in the Pantheon.
We do.
I mean, that's a good percentage of the Pantheon films
that's
that
true.
Include that plotline.
Now, Josh, as you most often do, and I occasionally do, and we both benefit from it, you put out on Twitter the call for ideas. Send us your picks. Give us some thoughts. Make sure we don't overlook some obvious choices here or some great choices here. And we did get a great question and a great nomination from a follower on Twitter who said, what about a movie like The Diving Bell and the Butterfly? Mm-hmm. Not a literal prisoner, but certainly a character suffering from locked-in syndrome, as they call it in the movie,
sure.
Unable to move his entire body except for, I think it's an eyelid, but otherwise brain functioning completely normally, trapped within a jail cell that is his body. The Diving Bell and the Butterfly should probably be on our list. Why isn't it?
I like that thinking, but I did go for more literal prisoners here.
Okay.
Just as a way to, I mean, a lot of times with these lists, there are so many possibilities you could pull in that you got to draw the line somewhere. So it's good thinking. It makes sense, but I set those aside. Maybe there's one. We'll see when we get to my list that isn't quite as literal in terms of bars and so forth, but you can let me know what you think then.
Okay. Who's your number five?
Another qualification I had is that I wanted these characters to have more than one jail scene. So it wasn't just like Heath Ledger's Joker in The Dark Knight. It's a fantastic prisoner scene. Or even someone like Gene Wilder in Blazing Saddles. He came to mind, but it's really a small part of the film. So.
Yeah, that's a really good point because I saw some people nominate something like Sullivan's Travels. And yes, there is a portion of that film where the main character, this movie director, becomes a prisoner. Probably a little bit of a stretch when it's just that small part of the film.
Yep, same thinking. All right, I'm going to start my list a little bit sobering manner here because I wanted a pick that reminded us movie prisoners aren't just characters. So often they're thrilling characters, or as we talked about in Startup, it's just a situation, if you're not familiar with, that fascinates you. But this is all drawn from harsh reality, right? I mean, this is a realistic segment of society, the prison system, with real people caught up in it. And so I'm going for my number five with Dennis Wigbe from The House I Live In. This is Eugene Jarecki's 2012 documentary, and it makes the case that America's war on drugs has been a massive failure, both in terms of law enforcement and as social policy, especially for the country's low-income minority citizens. It's mostly a talking head piece, and one of the interviewees is Dennis Wigbe, who grew up in a drug-infested New York City housing project. He eventually became a dealer himself. That landed him in jail. And now at the time we see him in the documentary, he's an ex-con who's moved to Florida and is starting a new life there. So technically, he's not a prisoner as a part of this documentary, but I couldn't resist putting him on this list because of a tragic parallel that Widby's story has to Startup. At the time of his interview with Jarecki, Wigbe has learned that his own son, Anthony Johnson, who's also interviewed in the doc, has been convicted of selling crack and is now facing 5 years in prison. At his own sentencing, Anthony, the son, talks about only knowing his father vaguely, but the one thing he did know was that he was a drug dealer. And so it paints this depressing portrait of a cycle of imprisonment, and I think Starred Up touches on that as well, with the main character's father being in the same prison complex. The Whidbey interview is really rich in the fact that there's some regret there, some resignation there, and it does give a face to the rest of the movie's statistics, because predominantly, I wish Jarecki had actually included more interviews with prisoners. He does have a few others who he talks to, but a lot of the time is given to academics or sociologists, and they have good stuff to offer, but it's getting to know someone like Whidbey, where we hear his story, and for me, that really made the documentary hit home.
You know, like, you say, all the things that you knew that when you was coming up, that was wrong. Now, I'm starting to do them, but I can't control it because I got these problems. I'm using drugs, I'm halfway selling drugs, I'm using drugs, and now I got these two little boys, just pretty boys.
Yeah, it does hit home. That's a really good choice. But now that, Josh, you've successfully depressed our entire listening audience.
Should I save that for number one?
With the crushing reality, I'm going to bring us back into the wonderful world of Hollywood
fantasy.
Okay,
that was enough reality.
Yeah, it is. Let's get into the fun. A movie that is so fantastic, in fact, that the Nazis in this movie seem about as threatening as the security guards here at Navy Pier.
I know where you're going.
And it is my number five choice, the John Sturges 1963 war epic, The Great Escape. This is 10 years after Stalag 17. Very similar, though. Americans in a German prisoner of war camp. Those were just Americans, or primarily Americans. This is an international ensemble, of course, in The Great Escape. You've got mostly British prisoners like Richard Attenborough, who's the squadron leader, but there's also Canadians. There's Lee Marvin playing an Australian, Charles Bronson, I think, playing a Polish prisoner. And there are a couple of Americans, like, famously, Cooler King Steve McQueen, who may be all over the posters for this movie, Josh, and was perceived as the star of this film. But my favorite character and my favorite performance in the movie is one of the other Americans, and it's Henley the Scrounger, played by James Garner.
Where's your kit?
This is it. The rest was confiscated in the last shakedown. The goons didn't appreciate some of my more personal items, such as...
You're the Scrounger.
Yes, that's right.
I'll need a camera.
What kind?
A good one. A 35mm f2.8 with a focal plane shutter should do all right.
All right.
And film, of course.
Of course.
James Garner just passed away. I thought it was a year ago or something. I looked it up. It was just a few months ago. It was this past July. He died at the age of 88, and I don't think his passing got a single mention here on the show, which is kind of sad looking back on it, because this is a guy who has 95 IMDb credits, most of them TV, known for his TV work, probably primarily. I think that's fair to say. He was Brett Maverick. He was Jim Rockford. And as a kid, I did love me some Rockford Files. I really did. But he has at least two great screen performances and probably many more. I just haven't seen enough of them. I'd be curious to hear from our listeners if there are some really memorable James Garner turns. But for me, he's Charlie Madison in The Americanization of Emily, the 1964 Arthur Hiller film with Paddy Chayefsky, another war set movie. He's so good there. And as Henley the Scrounger here in this movie, he's just such a comfortable, smooth screen presence. And he can be a real shrewd, fast talker, real capable with his vocabulary, like the character he plays in Emily, which was a Paddy Chayefsky penned screenplay. So he had to be that way. But I think of him more as he is here, as this kind of laconic observer. And then after observing, he acts, someone who can get the job done without a lot of drama. And he is similar. He's called the Scrounger. If you haven't seen The Great Escape, he's similar to Red, to the Morgan Freeman character from The Shawshank Redemption. He's someone who gets things. But here, he has to do it without the benefit of being able to bribe guards, right? He can't do that here. So he can't bring in anything from the outside world. It all has to come from within the camp. And I remember, Josh, watching the movie and being introduced to his character and thinking, well, they're just going to do some movie magic and they're going to say he's a guy who's really good at getting things and they'll say, go get this. And a couple scenes later, he'll show up with it. But the movie, true to its procedural style, it actually shows Henley acquire most of the items he does have to procure. And you see how smooth he is, how he is able to pull that off. The other thing about Henley that puts him really on this list for me is his friendship with another character, Blythe, the forger, played by Donald Pleasance, one of my other favorite performances in the movie. They're bunkmates, and they just develop such a strong bond that when Blythe loses his eyesight, James Garner's character actually vows to take responsibility for him, and he's going to ensure that he's not going to slow down the escape. He'll be with him arm in arm the whole way. That's a real big burden he takes on, and he does take it on and maintains it throughout that whole escape. So I love that James Garner character. In a movie filled with so many fun characters and interesting characters and faces that I kind of recognized, but I wasn't sure, and I was Googling them afterwards trying to figure out on IMDb what they were in. It was James Garner, actually, that really stood out. He was my favorite prisoner in The Great Escape, and he is a character, without a doubt. He's a complete Hollywood character, but that's one of the things you love about The Great Escape.
Yeah, I did consider that film, and I'm glad you went with someone other than McQueen because he's a blast in it, very good, but it is an ensemble picture,
yeah,
more than people remember, I think, because McQueen is such a star. I think any hesitation I have over that movie is what you alluded to, this jovial nature about it. And I noticed on Letterboxd when you wrote something that someone, I believe it was Corey Atad,
mm-hmm,
wrote back about with some historical reasons why that camp might have been run a little bit
which
more
is covered in the movie. It's
and
the
they
Luftwaffe,
mention it in the movie.
Not,
and so I understand a little bit, but still at the same time, this is a load of fun they're having in this camp.
Yeah,
and there's something, I don't know, the Hogan's Heroes element has always left me a little lacking about The Great Escape. So I'd consider it enduring entertainment, not a classic, but certainly a good pick for this
list.
Yeah,
that for me is another thing that holds it back. And I pose this question on Letterboxd. I wonder if audiences in 1963 watched The Great Escape and had in the back of their mind those other camps. Obviously, different camps.
Sure.
But the camps we think of when we think of German camps and knowing the atrocities that certainly people in 1963 did, I don't think we're any more enlightened about that now, probably. They knew that. And so they're watching these Americans and Canadians and all these people really just having the time of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And the Nazis running this camp are not a threat in any way whatsoever. It's hard to watch in that sense, whether there's any historical accuracy to it or not. It's something you have to wrestle with a little bit as you watch it.
Yep, for sure. All right, my number four is Jafar Panahi from This Is Not a Film.
I hate you.
And I have to give credit.
I hate you.
Don't hate me. Hate Martin Teller of the Film Spotting Advisory Board.
You,
he's the one who suggested
for getting
it.
To it before I did.
And I'm so glad he reminded me of it because this is the one where I wasn't quite sure.
The diving bell pick?
The diving bell pick. It's somewhat of another documentary here, like my number five, but not exactly. Panahi made This Is Not a Film in 2011 while he was under house arrest by the Iranian authorities. So it all takes place in his house, not a jail cell. He'd been banned from filmmaking and threatened with real imprisonment, but he is stuck at home here. He paces around for much of the film, makes little meals, takes calls from his attorney. When we reviewed it, I described it as a creative animal who's been put on a leash. At some point, Panahi decides he's going to turn the tables on this situation. So he persuades a fellow filmmaker to come to his apartment and record him reading sections of a screenplay that the Iranian government had rejected for production. Panahi's hope, in his words, is to create an image from it. And he succeeds to some degree, yet even after he employs props and he tries to tape the outlines of sets on his rug in his apartment, his ambition is he gets a little bit of an outlet, but he's also thwarted. So it's constantly this tug and pull between being stuck here and trying to evade what's been placed upon him. Now, since This Is Not a Film, Panahi has managed to co-direct a movie of similar subterfuge. It's called Closed Curtain, and from what I understand, it's more of a fiction feature, though it explores similar themes somewhat. I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but I can highly recommend This Is Not a Film. Jafar Panahi, my number four movie prisoner.
And listeners have heard us talk a little bit about the FAB over the years. This is why we have a Film Spotting Advisory Board with really smart volunteers who love to help out and do help us every week, but occasionally have these real moments of brilliance like that.
This was a gem.
Where they throw out a movie like This Is Not a Film that I think it's fair to say both of us would have completely overlooked as a prisoner movie, but he is under house arrest. He is a prisoner. And for a while, I kicked around a criteria. Did I need some criteria or a criterion that would help me form this list? And I thought for a while it might be fun to pick the movie prisoners who, if I had to be stuck in a jail cell with them, who are the ones I'd most want to be with? And Panahi would have been my number one choice.
Well, sure.
For that. And not only because obviously he's not threatening.
You're not
but,
in prison? But the food's
no.
better?
Well, no, I'm imagining, let's say we're actually in a prison.
Oh,
I would still
okay,
like to be
okay.
with
I'm
this
with
creative genius
yeah, yeah.
and see where his imagination takes us. So I had him on my list, and then I saw that it was going to make yours, and you beat me to it. And I had
sometimes
to,
it happens.
I had to get creative. My number four movie prisoner is Peter Blood in the Michael Curtiz swashbuckling film from 1935, Captain Blood. And really, I could save our listeners and us a lot of time here and just say two words, Errol Flynn. That's why he's my number four. That's all you really need to say, Errol Flynn.
That's all I need.
This was the first of several collaborations between Curtiz and Flynn. Same with the co-star here and love interest, Olivia de Havilland. She made eight movies with Flynn. It opens with him as this peace-loving doctor, doesn't want to choose a side in this rebellion against King James II. He gets arrested for tending to a wounded soldier fighting in that rebellion. And as he explains in my favorite scene in the movie, this courtroom showdown near the beginning of the movie with Judge Jeffries, he wasn't rebelling himself. He was just trying to fulfill his duties as a physician.
When this spit came to summon you, as you claim, did you know you were called to attend another rebel?
My business was with his wounds, not his politics.
Did you know the law? That any person who does knowingly receive, harbor, comfort, or succor a rebel is as guilty as if he himself bore arms?
I only knew my sacred duty as a physician.
Your sacred duty, rogue, is to your king.
I thought it was to my fellow men.
He is sentenced to death, though, and he's spared only because of a convenience, basically a plot contrivance, if you will. The king discovers he can sell prisoners as slaves in the West Indies. Everything about Flynn's Captain Blood is special. His intellect, his eloquence, his swashbuckling skills. And Curtiz, of course, emphasizes that specialness in the way he shoots Flynn, the heroic action shots, the glowing close-ups. And as good as Flynn is here, there is a sense watching the movie that Curtiz is still trying to find his way in that transition out of silent movies into talkies here in 1935. He hadn't quite mastered the form yet, the form he would arguably master in the 40s with movies like Casablanca and Mildred Pierce. Here, he's still using titles, intertitles, to kind of convey a lot of plot and exposition. Or when he's not doing that, it's almost as if Curtiz said, oh, I don't need all these titles. I can just have a character say everything that happened, which is
it's a transitional film in
yeah,
a lot of ways.
It is. And that isn't any more exciting to watch those characters explain their own transformations. More show would have been better in this movie than the tell we get. But if you've seen The Princess Bride, which I'm guessing most people listening have, and you've never seen Captain Blood, you should watch it because you'll immediately recognize why Cary Elwes was cast
sure.
as Wesley. There is undeniably a resemblance to Errol Flynn. The servant-turned-pirate love story is straight out of Captain Blood. And there's a duel scene in Blood that I would say is reminiscent of the battle here between Blood and the French pirate Captain Levasseur. So a good reason to see it if you love Princess Bride as much as I do, but I think the big reason is Errol Flynn. And that character is, as I said, just so special in every way he's captured on screen. It's, again, it's fantasy. It's complete Hollywood fantasy. I mean, he's unbeatable, but that's also why you're glued to the screen watching him.
I love Captain Blood. And the character trajectory that Flynn takes here, it's almost like a Charles Dickens action film because he just goes through so many transformations.
Yeah.
Yet you buy, and what I love is he's Flynn throughout, right? It's
yeah,
not
he is.
Like he
no.
makes any interior transformation.
No, and that's kind of my problem with it, right?
Well,
is that there's no interior.
But it's
just
a swashbuckler
this
too.
Happened.
So you know that's how it's going to work. And speaking of a recent top five list, the one you did with Michael Phillips, the pre-CGI special effects,
yeah.
I think the battle scenes at sea are just fantastic and how whether they used models, it must have been models of some form, but really hold up still today, I would
yeah,
say.
I didn't quite feel that. I mean, watching
really?
It recently, no, I felt like they were cluttered
they
in
were
a way
rickety
that,
and
a little bit, in
oh.
a way that not the effects, but the actual staging of
oh, how
the
they
sequences
were staged. Okay.
didn't really wow me as much as I've seen other good work.
Yeah,
from
I just remember being wowed by the effects themselves.
People on Letterboxd did chime in and say, if you're looking for a better, more accomplished Flynn Curtiz collaboration, it's The Seahawk from 1940.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't caught up with that one yet, but certainly want to after seeing Captain Blood.
All right, we each have three more picks left on our sentence, Adam. We'll get to those when the Film Spotting Top 5 finishes up next. Stay with us.
I had a friend named Ramblin' Bob. He used to steal, gamble, and rob. He thought he was the smartest guy around. jailhouse way downtown. He's in the jailhouse now. He's in the jailhouse now. Well, I told him once or twice to stop playing cards and shooting dice. He's in the jailhouse now.
Des fifres.
On a beau dire, ça vous pince.
Ce qui pince, mon vieux, c'est pas la musique, c'est pas les instruments. C'est le bruit des pas.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Josh Larson. And that was Jean Gabon as prisoner of war lieutenant marshal in Jean Renoir's Grand Illusion. It's my number three pick for our top five movie prisoners inspired by the new British prison drama Starred Up. And this is Renoir's 1937 canon entry, which follows a handful of French POWs who have been captured by the Germans in World War I. Now, like Renoir's The Rules of the Game, Grand Illusion is very much interested in class, how it forms barriers between people, how those barriers are really just an illusion. There's a real egalitarianism, I'd say, to both pictures. Marshall, the Gabon character, represents the French working class here. He's a rough and practical pilot who gets shot down early in the film. Among the other captives are an aristocratic captain, played by Pierre Frenet, and a nouveau riche Jewish officer, played by Marcel Dalio. It's a great cast, but Gabon's Marshall is the heart of the film for me, similar to your James Garner pick, I think. I can see some comparisons there. Really, more than the others, Marshall wears his emotions on his sleeve, whether he's joking about the silly rules of this POW camp at the beginning, or when he gets sent to solitary confinement later on, which is a pretty harrowing breakdown scene. He also has a great line in one of my favorite moments from the movie when the prisoners are watching a group of new German recruits who are marching to music. One of the Frenchmen leans out the window and says, "You must admit it's stirring." And Marshall grits his teeth and spits out, "It isn't the music that gets you, it's the marching feet." So you start to see those hackles come up there and in other scenes, which I really like. I only recently caught up with Grand Illusion, and it really does live up to its reputation. There's a lot of humor here about the absurdities of war, or really, I should probably say the absurdity of keeping up civilized formalities while war is going on. Eric von Stroheim plays this aristocratic German officer who tries to run his fortress prison almost like it's a high-class hotel of sorts. And so there's some playfulness with the delusions going on there. Grand Illusion, it really is a must-see.
Of course it's a must-see. You not only steal my Jafar Panahi pick. I'm going to say it's my pick.
Okay.
But then you go and choose a character from the movie I've been on record as saying is my number one biggest regret. The movie I'm most embarrassed to admit as a so-called cinephile that I've never seen. It is Renoir's Grand Illusion.
Do you feel proper shame?
I do feel proper shame. Good. And in my defense, though this is actually only going to make me sound a little bit worse as a cinephile, is it came down to, Josh, in preparation, I could either watch Grand Illusion or I could watch The Great Escape.
Which but was, The Great Escape is much longer.
It is much
that
longer.
That doesn't work
and
for
yet,
your...
And yet, I wanted to see what The Great Escape, what that fuss was all about. And I went with it.
You are
and I don't
losing
regret it.
All your snobbish credibility with this show.
Sure.
You just want to go with Tarantino's programming, never mind Scorsese.
Yep.
Putting aside Grand Illusion in favor of The Great Escape. What's happening to you, man?
I don't know. I don't know. I am changing here right before our eyes. My number three pick is the only prisoner I'm going to say on either of our lists. I'm going to go out on a limb and say on either of our lists who is a prisoner by choice. The movie is Shock Corridor, also from 1963, the same year as The Great Escape. The character is Johnny Barrett. He is a journalist played by Peter Breck who has this scheme, this design on winning a Pulitzer Prize. He thinks he's going to go inside this mental institution and get the story, get the scoop behind a murder that happened there. And that's going to be his ticket to the big time. He convinces an expert psychiatrist to basically teach him how to appear insane. So they'll take him in and, well, he's a good actor. It works. He tells them stories of incest with his sister, who he actually uses his girlfriend, who's an exotic dancer, to impersonate.
Johnny, you've got to be crazy to want to be committed to an insane asylum to solve a murder.
Even if I don't crack this case, honey, my experiences alone will make a book, a play, or even a movie sale.
But every man wants to get to the top of his profession. Mine is winning the Pulitzer Prize.
Johnny, if this story doesn't do it, nothing ever will.
But their sickness is bound to rub off on you.
I said the same thing to you when you started singing in your skin. Remember,
That's
Kathy?
Different.
But those hookers didn't get to you, did they? And those lunatics are not going to get to me.
He's right.
This is a film that we watched and discussed here on the show, but way back in 2006, it was part of our fourth ever marathon. We called it Overlooked Auteurs. We watched not only Shot Corridor, but The Big Red One. And I had to go back and look at my notes because it has been a while. And the things that really struck me about Shot Corridor and that Johnny Barrett character in particular is the different dichotomies that Fuller sets up, where you get someone who is pretending to be a fetishist, but as you see throughout the film, he clearly has some sexual issues. And then he has these dreams about Kathy and these paranoid notions that other men are wanting her. But then there is this notion that she wants some of these other men because she's so lonely, because he's not there. And then even his drive for the Pulitzer is a disorder of sorts. It's an obsession that's clearly causing him harm. The way Fuller shoots this institution, it's pulpy. It's black and white in the starkest way and off-putting, and the corridor itself is just really terrifying. It's made to look endless the way he uses shadows there. And it's also, Josh, I know you love movies about the American dream. You get to know four characters
yes,
in this movie, and all four of them either go crazy or were driven crazy in pursuit of their version of the American dream. And at the end of the film, you see whether or not he gets what he wants. You have to ask yourself, yes, but was it worth the cost? Was the payoff and the pursuit really worth it?
All right, you can feel better. You got me there. I have not seen Shot Corridor, so nice pick. My number two, it's a little different, similar to how yours was someone who wanted to be in prison. Mine is different from the rest in that I think everyone so far in my number one is also like this. They haven't really been evil figures who have been imprisoned or even bad guys. In fact, most are wrongfully accused imprisoned heroes of some kind, but not so here with my number two. I think everyone would agree this guy belongs in a prison of some sort. It's Anthony Hopkins' Hannibal Lecter from The Silence of the Lambs. This is the imprisoned and Oscar-winning serial killer in Jonathan Demme's 1991 thriller, Demme, and the picture itself also took home awards. Adam, your number four film of 1991 was Silence of the Lambs when we did those lists recently.
That sounds right.
Is that right? Yeah. And I think when you talked about it, you mentioned the stillness that he has in that first scene between him and Jodie Foster when he's in his glass-walled cell. And that's certainly a key quality of his performance. He has this sadistic sort of serenity. He's poised to strike at any time, and he uses that cell to his every advantage. There's nowhere to hide, so he does something scary or just stands directly in the middle in plain sight, which you talked about. I think it speaks to a shamelessness in him about who he is and about his crimes. He just has an utter lack of remorse. That all happens in the cell with those glass walls, but later he's transferred to something more like a cage.
Yeah.
And this is where we get another one of the tense meetings with Foster, and I love Demi's use of the bars here in this scene. Although she's supposed to be the law and he's supposed to be the prisoner, our view of both is obstructed by the bars. They're equally trapped. And even when we move into the close-ups, the blurry lines of the bars on either side of the frame, we can see them a little bit for both of them, for both characters. And then as Lecter begins to lecture her, the shot of him holds still, even as it gets closer, so that his bars almost fade away, while the shot of Foster pulls back to include more bars, and she starts pacing back and forth. She becomes more desperate. She seems more caged. And again, it's this sense of the captive being in control that really is Lecter's defining quality.
You were telling me the truth back in Baltimore, sir. Please continue now.
Well, I've read the case files, have you? Everything you need to find him is right there in those pages.
And tell me how.
First principles, Clarice. Simplicity. Read Marcus Aurelius. Of each particular thing, ask, what is it in itself? What is its nature? What does he do, this man you seek?
He kills women.
No, that is incidental.
Fantastic choice. Can't argue with Hannibal Lecter at all. My number two movie prisoner comes from my second favorite performance by an actor in 2010 in my second favorite film of 2010. It's Tahar Rahim in the Jacques Audiard film, A Prophet. It was nominated for the Palme d'Or in 2009. It won the Grand Jury Prize, and it was also nominated for Best Foreign Language Film at the Oscars in 2010. It's the film on my list that most reminds me of Startup, actually, because Rahim plays a young man. I think he's 19, a little bit older than the character Eric in Startup, but he's a French Muslim who is given the 6-year prison sentence, and we don't really know why. We don't really have a sense of whether or not he deserves to be there or belongs there, but it comes through in his personality that he is way out of his element. Unlike Jack O'Connell in Startup, this is a kid who really is truly frightened and has no idea what's ahead of him or how to behave or prepare for it. And the Corsican mob runs this prison and is kind of at odds with the Muslim contingent in the prison. And they give him a task early on in the film, say, you have to do this or we're going to kill you. He has no choice if he wants to survive, but to do what they ask him to do. And it's a harrowing, harrowing scene that ends up kind of scarring him throughout the whole rest of the movie. Another way it reminds me of Startup a little bit is in the way the movie does really clearly set up the rules of this society inside this prison. You kind of get a real understanding of the rituals and the way people get along here or don't get along between these walls. And even though it's certainly a crime-based drama, it's a prison movie like we've seen before, it really does use those conventions to get at some larger issues of identity and how you assimilate into a different culture. Rahim's performance, I interviewed him at Sundance back in 2009, and I did bring this up with him. It seems like really high praise, but he reminded me of a really young Robert De Niro in The Godfather 2. That same sense of that young Vito Corleone character who doesn't say a whole lot, doesn't need to say a whole lot. He's just always listening. He's always watching. And by the end of the film, you do see how this character transforms into being not that scared kind of victim anymore, but someone who actually does assimilate. Not only that, takes control of his life, discovers what his identity really is. And just watching him kind of maneuver around the prison and get an understanding of each faction and each individual's desires and the things they're after and how to play those against each other really is one of the strengths of this movie. He's a really smart character who figures out not only how to live, but how to thrive in this setting.
Well, I'm going to stick with foreign language films for my number one. Going back a little bit farther, though, with the character of Fontaine from A Man Escaped, when we did our Robert Bresson marathon, I think it was about 2 years ago, we both named François Leterrier as the best actor of the marathon for his role in A Man Escaped. I think we reviewed the film itself on episode 386. Leterrier plays a French resistance fighter who gets captured and sent to a German POW camp in World War II, and this was partly based on Bresson's own experiences. It's similar also to Jack O'Connell's performance in Startup in that it's very physical as opposed to verbal. We see a lot of scenes of Leterrier chiseling at his door with a spoon handle. He's creating rope from strips of torn bedding, and he repeats these acts with this liturgical devotion. He's like a monk meditating on his freedom. Leterrier's face is also intensely scrutinized by Bresson's camera, as he often does with his actors. Yet, despite that, I think Leterrier, he's intensely inscrutable. He betrays nothing in these scenes. But because of the ritual, because of the routine that we've been immersed in, we know what he's intensely focusing on, how to get out. If you're new to Bresson, I think this 1956 film is probably a good place to start. It's very much in the unadorned aesthetic of a lot of his films, but also is within this prison escape genre that you can easily place yourself in. So, and I think you actually named this as your favorite film of the marathon, if I'm remembering correctly.
I guess I'm just not as into being beaten up as you are, Josh, with some of those other Bresson films that are more grim. This is, as you said, kind of an action picture. You can get lost in
different kind, but
in that. But you're right, completely different and still in every way feels like a Bresson film. So I love that choice of Fontaine as your number one. My number one, I started with Henley from The Great Escape. I'm going to cap off my Stalag 17 memorial list with another prisoner of war movie. If you take the sense of duty and leadership abilities of Richard Attenborough in The Great Escape, combine it with the sense of duty and philosophical eloquence of my number four, Peter Blood, the ambition and obsessiveness of my number three, Johnny Barrett from Shock Corridor, and my number two, Malik, his understanding of human nature, you'd get my number one, Alec Guinness, in the role that won him a Best Actor Oscar, Colonel Nicholson from Bridge on the River Kwai. He's the senior British officer in this Japanese prisoner of war camp, and we're really introduced to him and his integrity, I guess, his commitment to rules and order when he refuses the instruction to perform manual labor. The camp leader, Saito, wants him to help his men build a bridge that must be built. And he refuses because the Geneva Conventions say that officers should be exempt from that type of manual labor. And he suffers the consequences for his stubbornness. He ends up in this iron box and he doesn't get any food or water. The heat is obviously overwhelming. And as you watch this film, it's hard to imagine. You get to the end of the film. It's hard to imagine someone so seemingly noble and forthright as Colonel Nicholson is losing his way or becoming maybe a villain even in the movie. But the same resolve and unwillingness to bend it takes to go into that iron box and not be willing to compromise your integrity, that's the same resolve and unwillingness to bend that could lead to the types of questionable decisions we see from him as the movie goes on. It's a profoundly gray area that nevertheless could be seen as starkly black and white. He's building a bridge that helps the enemy. He ultimately does decide to intervene as a commanding officer, but he's going to do it right. He's not going to sabotage this bridge. And that question becomes a thorny one throughout the rest of the film. He is this sympathetic, well-meaning figure, but his drive and his sense of dignity is so strong that it does, as I said, maybe make him into another villain in the movie to go along with Saito. And I think that that performance is remarkable from Alec Guinness, but really it's that character and that complexity to it and seeing how he transforms and really as a viewer having to question how you feel about him and decide which side you're on and having that unbelievable task of trying to pick a side, I think is really the beauty of Bridge on the River Kwai.
Would you prefer to see this battalion disintegrate in idleness? Would you have it said that our chaps can't do a proper job? Don't you realize how important it is to show these people that they can't break us in body or in spirit? Take a good look, Clifton. One day the war will be over. I hope that the people who use this bridge in years to come will remember how it was built and who built it. Not a gang of slaves, but soldiers, British soldiers, Clifton, even in captivity.
Yes, sir.
You're a fine doctor, Clifton, but you've a lot to learn about the army.
Good pick, but no Bobby Sands?
Bobby Sands,
Hunger?
My number one honorable mention.
Okay. I don't know. I don't know if the public, let alone Michael Fassbender, will accept that.
I've got a lot of good honorable mentions. Those are our top five movie prisoners. Speaking of those honorable mentions, which ones did you have a tough time leaving off, Josh?
Bobby Sands was one. My number six, though, was probably Maria Falconetti's Joan from The Passion of Joan of Arc.
Wow, didn't even think about her.
Came close to putting that on the list. Completely different direction would be the pair of Eddie Murphy and Martin Lawrence in Life, which is this underrated Ted Demme movie.
Is it?
It really is. I mean, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I liked it quite a bit when it came out. I have to give credit to Phil Lipp on Facebook for that. He reminded me of that one. Solomon Northup from 12 Years of Slave certainly could have been on this list, as well as Tom Hardy's Bronson, another touchstone for Starred Up. Caesar from Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Thought about that one. And a few more here. Sean Penn in that wrecking performance from Dead Man Walking. And from this year, M. Gustave, The Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yeah,
he gets
More
than one jail scene, but wasn't quite enough to make the list.
And see, leave it to you, Josh. I was sure that you were going to surprise me there for a second, and you were going to make me feel terrible about overlooking a great Eddie Murphy prisoner performance, and you go with Life. No, I'm thinking of Reggie Hammond from 48 Hours.
you could go that direction, too.
That deserves to be mentioned. My honorable mentions have all been mentioned, or almost all of them so far. As I said, you stole Jafar Panahi from This Is Not a Film.
You're never going to recover
from that. You stole Fontaine from Man Escaped. Hannibal Lecter, strongly considered, but has gotten a lot of praise from me lately. Bobby Sands from Hunger, we mentioned. Snake Plissken, Escape from New York. Red, not Andy Dufresne, everyone on Twitter. Red's the better movie prisoner from Shawshank Redemption. And then I have to go back to my guy, Werner Herzog, Dieter Dengler.
Yeah.
In the documentary, Little Dieter Needs to Fly, and also Christian Bale's performance as Dengler in Rescue Dawn. And just to cap it off with your favorite movie ever, Josh, Odaisu from Old Boy.
Oh, my goodness.
Not the Spike Lee remake, of course, the
original
Odaisu.
I'm so glad you didn't put that on your list, so we didn't have to get into that.
Again, those are our top five movie prisoners. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, Dolphin Tale 2 and No Good Deed, a home invasion thriller with Idris Elba and Taraji P. Henson.
I laugh about Dolphin Cocktail 2 because I'm avoiding seeing that by telling my kids he gets a mechanical head in this one. Now they're just freaked out. They don't want anything to do with it.
How did you even come up with that? You are a sick man.
Oh, it's obvious. Where else are you going to go with the sequel?
Out in limited release, a few movies we're going to highlight. The Home Stretch. This is the latest from the great Chicago documentary house, Kartemkun Films. Yes, the people who gave us Hoop Dreams and The Interrupters, among other films. It's a film that focuses on three homeless Chicago teens. And really excited to see this movie, despite the sort of heavy subject matter. But that is out now in a movie I do intend to see. Finding Fela is playing at the Music Box. This is a documentary about the Afrobeat star Fela Kuti, directed by Alex Gibney. I think he actually directs every documentary that's made these days, except the ones from Kartemkun. And then we have to recognize two movies that got love during my fall movie preview. Yeah. On my list of those top five things I was most excited about, The Drop opens this weekend. My number five was seeing Tom Hardy act with James Gandolfini in that movie. And The Skeleton Twins, my number four, seeing SNL alums Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig. The trailer just completely won me over. And I'm just going to choose to overlook the fact that you've seen this movie and your initial response to it was negative, Josh. I'm just going to ignore that.
You can't pick them all, Adam. That's all right.
Next week on the show, we're going to talk about The Skeleton Twins.
Should be interesting.
I'm going to hope even more to really like it so we can have a good battle. And we're going to introduce a new segment on the show, one we've been discussing for a little while. We're going to call it Blind Spotting.
Uh-huh.
We're going to discuss a movie that we have both been meaning to see, kind of going back to your pick of Grand Illusion.
Right.
Movies like
that
Grand Illusion.
We're embarrassed
we haven't seen. And I'm sitting here as the guy who talks incessantly about Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive. And I love The Elephant Man, among other David Lynch films. And yet I have never seen Eraserhead.
And I recently
caught up with it
like two, maybe 3 weeks ago. I think it was in relation to our top five magical realism moments.
Maybe.
I thought that might
fit. But it didn't make the list.
That's what goes on there is way beyond magical realism.
Well, it's out now, or it's coming out in a week or so on Blu-ray. And I have that Blu-ray at home.
Beautiful.
And I cannot wait to watch that Blu-ray edition of Eraserhead. So we're going to talk about that. And then the top five, it's up in the air.
Yeah, I mean,
we need help.
We could go sibling relationships related to the Skeleton Twins. That's obvious way. Brother, sister, maybe even. I don't think we've done either of those.
Mm.
I'd love to do Lynch scenes, though. You've seen enough.
Lynch scenes.
Yeah. I mean, think of that.
I could be easily talked into that.
Let's do it.
All right.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, especially for that Panahi pick this week. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
The wife-killing banker.
Oh, you got to do the, and I'm Josh Larson. Sorry.
That's not
in the script for some reason.
I can only do what's exactly
I know,
written there.
I know.
So don't try to trick
Actually,
me up.
It's funny. We were talking about Maddie because Maddie used to do that all the time. And I'd call him on it and he'd go, hey, I'm just a trained monkey.
Exactly.
So
what do you expect here?
Yeah.
All right. Let's try again.
Three, two, one.